the worst part is that because the media doesn't help us, they keep publishing stories about people getting pregnant at the age of 50 and 45. And people don't realize that this is donor eggs. So they don't, in the media, it's not mentioned, it's donors. So I have to work with an older population, a lower reserve, advanced maternal age, and they expect to have 60% chances of getting pregnant per embryo transfer.
This podcast is meant to provide information on reproductive health. It does not establish a physician-patient relationship, and we would urge you to contact your treating provider regarding your care.
Welcome back with Dr. Kyle as we continue our conversation about fertility treatments in other parts of the world.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about fertility in the Middle East and what questions that patients should be asking that oftentimes they do not ask when they come and see you.
I think that in general, fertility in the Middle East is the same as in anywhere in the world. So there is a crisis with, you know, increased infertility rates around the world. The question that is really very difficult that people come to you with and they don't understand what they're asking for. They come to you and say, what is your clinic success rate? How would you want me to quote you a clinic success rate? Or do you want me to sit with you and give you a full detail of my key performance indicators? A patient should be asking, what are my own chances of getting pregnant, my own case, my age, my diagnosis? Because the success rate in a tubal infertility is not the same success rate as in a severe male factor or azoospermia. So people don't look at their individual picture. They want to know how good you are as a clinic in general. And I think this is really biased. And they should learn to ask, what are my chances, my condition to be getting pregnant?
You bring up an absolutely amazing point. So I'm so grateful you just mentioned this. So a couple of things that I picked up on. So first of all, here in the United States, we have some objective ways of measuring success rates. So there's SART, there's a CDC where clinics publish their success rates every year. But the way how these things are set up is that it becomes very difficult for a patient to go to these sites and figure out what success rates are just based on the statistics. Even me as a physician, it's very complicated now. SART used to be very easy for me to read it and say, oh, that's a success rate for that clinic in that age group. Now it's very complicated now, and I personally don't understand it. So one, the objective websites are more complicated today than they used to be. Two, the second thing you mentioned is the key performing indexes for that specific clinic. And I will tell you, each clinic, including ours, we keep our own internal data of what our success rates are. And overall in 2023, 24, 25, just an overall, what is our success rates? We keep that for ourselves just so we know if things are improving in the lab, those types of things for our own personal improvement. But you're absolutely right. The one thing that you said, which really hit home with me, is not the clinic success rate, but the success rate of the couple sitting in front of me. And you're absolutely right. The 44-year-old sitting in front of me has a very different success rate than the 21-year-old whose fallopian tubes are blocked. Very, very different success rate. And the success rate is not the success rate of the clinic. At that time, it really becomes the success rate of that specific couple and what their factors are that will make them, whether it's an 80% success rate or a 5% success rate, right? So the success rate really varies from couple to couple and less so to do with the clinic, because the clinic that only sees 21-year-olds with tubal factor, they're going to have very high success rates versus the clinic that's known for seeing the more difficult cases with diminished ovarian reserve. They're going to have much lower success rates. I mean, a clinic like, even all the clinics in the Middle East, like you mentioned, you cannot do donor egg. So you're doing, you're utilizing eggs continuously where you know the quantity quality is poor, and you're going to continue to get lower success rates, not because of your lab or you, it's you cannot move on to donor egg. And so the majority of your patients may be people who are doing 5, 6, 7 egg retrievals, but still not getting to that success rate. The other thing I also tell patients is that the 42-year-old that sits in front of me, she has a day 5, 5AA embryo. So an embryo that's graded nicely, and that embryo tests correct in the PGTA. And the 21-year-old that sits in front of me with the same day 5, 5AA embryo that tests correct on the PGTA testing, same grade, both are euploid on PGTA testing. The embryo coming from the 21-year-old egg still has a higher pregnancy success rate than the embryo coming from the 42-year-old egg. Same grade, same testing on the PGTA testing. And a lot of that has to do with the intrinsic material within the egg and the embryo, the machinery, the mitochondria, all the things within the cytoplasm that makes that embryo differentiate and become a fetus and a live birth. Those things are still, those things matter as well, in addition to just a grade and the PGTA testing.
I can't agree more. It's absolutely correct what you're saying. Comparing the same embryos coming from a young lady to an older woman. But this is where I want to use the word hit a wall. It is very difficult to explain to people that even though you transfer an euploid embryo, a normal chromosome count embryo to the uterus, it is not the same when you're older than when you are young. And the worst part is that because the media doesn't help us, they keep publishing stories about people getting pregnant at the age of 50 and 45. And people don't realize that this is donor eggs. So they don't, in the media, it's not mentioned, it's donors. So I have to work with an older population, a lower reserve, advanced maternal age, and they expect to have 60% chances of getting pregnant per embryo transfer.
You're absolutely right. So celebrities, people in the media that say, hey, I got pregnant at 45, 50. Well, unless you froze embryos 20 years ago, this was most likely donor egg. And you're not sharing with people that this was donor egg. And so the expectation from the general public is, oh, I can get pregnant with my own eggs at 45 or 50 easily because this other person did so. And it's setting unrealistic expectations for our patient population. And also the patient sitting in front of me is expecting that. And it's difficult for me to have to explain that's not going to be your success rate. That's not real. And so it's important that the media share what really is happening. And I will tell you, one of the reasons I started this podcast, one of the reasons I wrote the book, one of the books behind of me, Miracle Baby, A Fertility Doctor's Fight for Motherhood, I did IVF 5 times and ultimately surrogacy to have my only child. And people need to know that. People need to know I had a child at 41, but it took me 5 rounds of egg retrievals and a surrogacy to have that one child. It was not easy. And that was at age 41. That's not age 45 and certainly not age 50, which is drastically lower. And that's also one of the reasons I started this podcast, is to share awareness. People need to know, start earlier, have your at least freeze eggs or embryos earlier in life. As you pursue your career or wait until you meet the right person, because even though technology has improved and we're living longer in today's day and age, our biological clock still hasn't caught up as yet.
Yep, absolutely. Until we can make eggs, and I think the first egg has been made a couple of weeks ago, it was published, until it is not research anymore, we have nothing in our hands to turn back the biological clock. And it's a fact that women have to understand that, which makes me want to talk about age. Age matters.
Yes. So for our listeners, I want to tell our listeners what Dr. Kael just alluded to is in vitro gametogenesis, where we can take, it's only experimental now. So I want to make sure our listeners understand that this is only experimental at this stage. But essentially, you can take a skin cell and revert it back to being what we called an induced pluripotent stem cell. And so revert it back, a pluripotent stem cell is a cell in an embryo that can become anything. It can become hair cells, eye cells, leg cells, muscle cells. So you can take a skin cell from an adult, revert it back in the lab to becoming a pluripotent stem cell, and then take that pluripotent stem cell and differentiate it into anything else, differentiate it into becoming an egg cell, a sperm cell. We use it in research today to help people with Parkinson's, to help people with cardiomyopathy, so differentiate it into nerve cells, into heart cells, help people who are suffering with chronic disease. At this stage, it's still incredibly experimental, and it's not certainly not ready for prime time. So until then, we really are, there's no real way until it becomes something that we can do commercially. There's no real way to give yourself back your egg cells that you would have had 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And I think it's very important what you're saying, because you are explaining to the public what they read in the newspapers, what they read in magazines, and they think that it's going to be common practice that I'm going to use stem cell and make new eggs. But it is very good to emphasize that this is still research. It's not applicable yet on clinical bedside practice.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about in the Middle East, are y'all doing a lot of artificial intelligence for your IVF?
It's starting. We're getting there. You know, the cost of it is very high, and it has to be cost effective if you want. For the moment, we use everything in our, you know, like embryoscopes but I have yet to, and some clinics are using AI for sperm selection. We had some issues with using AI for egg selection for political reasons and where the servers are located, but it is getting there slowly but surely.
Yes, artificial intelligence in the fertility world, particularly in the embryology lab, it's growing. It's, again, just like you said, some aspects are ready for prime time and other aspects are not. But we're using it too more frequently for sperm selection, taking pictures of eggs prior to freezing them, embryo selection, but also in terms of helping us with quality control in the lab as well. And I think it's the artificial intelligence in the embryology lab is still in its infancy, and it will continue to grow in the next decade or two.
Yeah, I think that AI in the lab is important. AI will be helping the embryologist choose the best embryo, but I don't think that AI will be the one choosing the embryo by itself. It's analyzing pictures. It's helping the embryos to see things that the human eye might miss. So we're getting there, but I don't think that AI will ever replace the embryologist or the physicians treating the patients.
I agree with you. AI is great. And it's for our listeners, any form of artificial intelligence, what it does, it learns certain patterns, and based on certain patterns, what the outcome of those patterns may be. So after looking at thousands and thousands of eggs or sperm or embryos, based on certain patterns of the eggs, the sperm, or the embryos, and which ones ultimately resulted in good fertilization in terms of eggs and sperm or live birth, the artificial intelligence tool, it learns that, oh, certain aspects of this embryo means that embryos containing this particular feature are more likely to result in a live birth than the other embryo that does not have this particular feature. And so it helps us in terms of selecting embryos, but you're absolutely right. I don't think it will replace a physician or an embryologist, but I think it really helps us as a tool to help patients pick the better embryo, help them with their IVF cycle by picking the better embryo, get to implantation or live birth on perhaps maybe the first frozen transfer instead of the second or the third transfer. So I think it'll be a great tool, just like this podcast. You know, 30, 40 years ago, the ability of a doctor like myself in Dallas-Fort Worth or in Dubai to be able to share our experiences with the rest of the world, that was not possible. And because of things like podcasts, we can do so now. And it's us, it's the information that you and I are sharing today. It's educational information, but it still doesn't replace a patient going to their physician and establishing a physician-patient relationship, and that physician learning about that patient and designing protocols and treatments that are individualized for that specific patient. Podcasts like today's, it's to educate people about options that are available all over the world, which is amazing that you're on this podcast with me.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Really, it is important, you know, exchanging ideas, exchanging knowledge, and sharing the knowledge with the public, you know, in simple words. And because sometimes they go on the net and they ask ChatGPT and they ask things and they come to you with, you know, sometimes it's really relevant questions, but the ChatGPT is not going to tell you who you are as a human being and is not going to be able to communicate and establish a rapport, as you rightly said, patient-physician relationship.
Y'all know I like to finish my episodes with debunking the myths. So I'm going to ask Dr. Kyle a few things. Dr. Kyle, patient comes to you and says, I asked ChatGPT what my success rates are and what I should be doing for my fertility. Is this correct?
Well, patients do go to ChatGPT and ask them what they should do. And patients come to me with tailored treatments that they think is the best for them. Yet ChatGPT has not sat with them and discussed the case, saw their age, saw the real picture in front of him.
Excellent. So ChatGPT is great for information, but does not give us individualized care that you can get from your physician, correct?
Absolutely. Trust your physician.
Here's another myth. Age is just a number.
Oh, I wish that age was just a number. Age is the most important factor in a woman's fertility. We have to understand that we are born with a certain number of eggs, and with age, we lose our eggs, and the quality of our eggs will deteriorate, which will make us less prone to get pregnant and more prone to get miscarriages.
Here's another myth. If I do IVF, I'm guaranteed twins.
Absolutely not. First of all, most of the times we transfer one embryo, so we know what we're transferring. So if you transfer one, either you're not pregnant or you're pregnant with one. In some instances, you transfer two, but still, either you're not pregnant or you're pregnant with one or pregnant with two. And I do not like transferring two.
Particularly when there are tested embryos, and now that we don't have, reduced preterm deliveries and the technology has improved, single embryo transfer is the right way to go. I absolutely agree with you.
The golden standard.
Here's another myth. If I do IVF, I'm 100% guaranteed that I will get a baby.
No, absolutely not. Chances of getting pregnant with PGTA tested embryos is around 60%. Don't forget that you can be in the 40% that are not pregnant. But do remember that the more you try, the more chances of getting pregnant.
Exactly. Here's another myth. Infertility is a woman's fault.
It's always women's fault. This is what men wants us to believe. But to get pregnant, you need an egg and you need sperm. And to make an embryo, it's eggs and sperm. And male fertility counts for at least 40% of infertility.
I absolutely agree with you. When I do the testing for fertility, in the causes that I do find, it's about 50-50 when I find a specific cause for the infertility. So both, you're right, both the eggs and sperm matter.
it is very important to start the testing at the same time for the male and the female, for both partners at the same time. Because if you start with the woman, you're wasting time and everything is fine. And then it ends up by being a male factor in fertility. So I always recommend to do the testing in parallel, man and woman.
And I agree with you. You hit on a really important point. And I believe both members of the couple need to be tested at that same time. Having just one person go and get tested and the other person not tested, that does not give us as a clinician the big picture of what's going on. So they need to be tested at the same time. And things change with time and age. And so your test 2 years ago that showed a normal semen parameters is not the same as what it would be today. So things do change with time and age. So testing around the same time matters and doing treatment related to that testing matters. And for our listeners out there, when we do testing, testing is like taking a snapshot of today's picture. It's, you know, back in the old days, we used the Polaroid camera and it printed the picture immediately. It's taking a snapshot of today. It gives us an idea of what's going on now, but it will not tell me what will happen a year from now, 2 years from now. So things do change with time and age. So it's very important that they get testing together, getting the big picture together now, but not do testing now and then wait another year or two to do treatment, because many times I have to repeat the testing because the sperm and eggs have advanced in age.
Absolutely. I totally agree with your statement.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like, follow, subscribe, and share so you do not miss an episode and your friends and family can learn about fertility treatments.
Pioneer.